Be seated. Good morning, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this April 18 panel. We have six cases on our calendar this morning, four of which are on our oral hearing consideration and two non-oral cases considered only on the briefs. The first matter on for oral argument this morning is Dominion Management versus Lee and others. Just to remind you of our rules, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel to use for rebuttal if you would like. Please be mindful of those timing restrictions. They're indicated in the podium with a light and a clock so you know how much time you have remaining. And by the way, you can elevate or lower the lectern to match your height at your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep track of the arguments and the audio recording of the proceedings. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready, you may have the floor.
Thank you and good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Christopher Kalla. I am the attorney representing Dominion Management Services, LLC, the appellant and landlord in this eviction appeal. This is an eviction for breach of lease. The two issues before the court as I see them, one, to what extent does the innocent tenant defense enunciated in Minnesota Statute 504B-171 apply? And two, do the facts support the referee's findings and conclusions? The tenants are still in possession.
Can I ask you a big picture question?
Yes.
I've got a few of them, but one comes to my mind right away. Is the lease at all relevant, the language of the lease, for appeal purposes? As I understand it, and this is just as a matter of record, I guess I have a question as a matter of record and as a matter of law. As a matter of record, am I correct that the lease that was in effect at the time of the eviction in this case is not in the record?
So the lease that was put in the record has a date that became effective after the events, but
right,
it was signed before.
So there was a lease that was in effect before this subsequent lease.
Yes, and that was an issue not raised at the trial court. It was raised sua sponte by Judge Cook at the judge review.
Right, but as far as our appellate record is concerned, do we have in the record the lease that was in effect at the time of the eviction?
I can tell you, I know that the lease language is exactly the same.
Well, your representation is very interesting, but we can't cite to your representation. We have to consider whether we have in the record the lease, and that's my question. Is it in the record or not?
No, and the argument I raised with Judge Cook after he raised that sua sponte, he wanted to know specifically what interplay does that have with his decision, and I suggested that not being an issue raised by the tenants at the lower court, at the trial court level with referee Levine, if that's an issue that we now think might be relevant, we would ask the simple case be remanded so that we could introduce that document.
That's not usually what we do on appeal. I mean, you have to augment the record, supplement the record if you have a document that's relevant but not in front of us.
Right, and as a non-moving party, my ability to do that is quite limited. And my position was that issue not being raised by the defendants at the trial and only being raised sua sponte by Judge Cook, and then not be a reason by Judge Cook to affirm the decision for referee Levine, I was proceeding under the impression that that was no longer an issue that this court would be interested in. I mean, I appreciate your Honor's inquiry, but I don't...
Well, but if you're asking us to interpret the language of the contract, and we don't have the contract except as it's been described in your brief, I don't want to...
Sure, the lease.
Tie up all of your time on this issue, but it seems to me to be a procedural one of some significance.
The lease was offered. There was no objection. It was accepted into evidence. And so, for the purposes of.
When you say the lease was offered, you're talking about the lease.
A lease was offered.
A lease, not the lease that is applicable to the circumstances, the timing.
Correct.
Okay.
But regardless, the operative language of the lease that was offered was not in dispute as to be the contract language that the tenants had agreed to.
Well, your scope on review is whether the evidence supports the findings and whether the findings supports the court's conclusion. So this goes to the question of what evidence do we have about the existing lease at the time of the eviction?
You have the pieces of papers that were offered as evidence and the fact that the tenants did not object. I would argue that that's, at a minimum, a stipulation that regardless of what date that lease may have, the tenants didn't have any dispute that that was the lease language that controlled. And to be clear, the lease that was introduced
burden
was...
Burden of proof at these eviction proceedings is yours, right?
Yes.
So why should the tenant be charged with having to object? You have to prove it or you lose.
The date that the lease was signed predated March 8th, 2018, the date of the events. It was a lease renewal.
Well, you're saying the lease was signed before the date of the events, but it was a lease that would not become effective until after the events. So I don't know how, as a matter of contract law, the effective dates of the lease not applying to the eviction, why we would consider that at all. I don't want you to spend all of your time on this issue, but it was a concern. It was raised in the respondent's brief, and I didn't see any discussion in your reply brief saying that, contending that the lease that was applicable is in front of us.
Because it was waived by the tenants at the first appearance. And that order, I mean, that issue was addressed by Judge Cook on review, and he didn't indicate any reason why that issue should play a factor in denying the tenant, the landlord's application for the writ. But that notwithstanding, I mean, the issue that the tenants are really raising here is that the lease language cannot overcome the innocent tenant defense in 504B171. And so as a matter of law, even setting the lease aside, the central question then becomes, to what extent does that innocent tenant defense in 171 allow the tenants to escape an eviction simply because, under their claim, they didn't know about the drug use at the property? And I argue that precedent, both under Minnesota law and United States Supreme Court law, indicates that that defense is unavailing. In the Phillips case, Phillips Neighborhood Housing Trust versus Brown from 1997, the statute in play at the time was 504B181. And the only difference between 181 and 171 today is the inclusion of adding the word landlord and lessor as also being bound by the obligations and the covenants to not allow unlawful activity. And in Phillips, the tenants argued the innocent tenant defense. I mean, their brief at the Court of Appeals said, Minstat 504-181 gives the trial court discretion when evicting the tenant who possessed illegal drugs in the property to allow the co-tenant and her minor children who were not aware of the illegal drug possession to remain on the property. They say that the landlord did not provide other good cause to justify eviction where they had no knowledge of the lease violation. This issue has been squarely addressed by this court in a published decision. And interesting, it's the Phillips decision that then gets cited by the Rucker case at the Ninth Circuit. Rucker v. Davis, 203 F3rd 627. They cite the Phillips decision on page 644. And they quote, there's a strong public policy interest in eliminating drugs from subsidized housing. Evicting those who violate the lease by having controlled substances in their apartments is the landlord's most effective, if not its only effective, means of eliminating drugs and providing a safe environment.
So you're quoting from which opinion now?
That's Rucker at the Ninth.
So Rucker...
Well, that's Rucker quoting Phillips.
Okay, so, but Rucker stands for the proposition, according to the opinion itself, that the statute that was in play in that case, 42 U.S.C. 1437D, unambiguously requires the lease terms to impose this restriction on tenants regardless of whether there's knowledge of the misconduct.
Yes, that's the federal mandate within the public housing and the HUD model lease.
Right, correct. But the holding in that case was simply an interpretation of the statute and imposing a requirement in the lease. Are you suggesting that that statute requires that same strict liability in this lease?
I'm not saying it requires it. I'm saying that Rucker at the U.S. Supreme Court empowers the PHA, if you will, to draft leases that cover that directive.
Well, that's not what, I mean, the court is not, I mean, it's limited to its, we're limited to what the holding was, and the holding there was simply saying that when this statute applies, this kind of lease, this provision in the lease is required as a matter of federal law.
Yes.
But that requirement isn't imposed in the lease in this case. Am I correct or not correct about that?
Yes, the lease language that the landlord elected to include in their lease doesn't derive necessarily from that mandate. I mean, and really the only difference between the lease language in 171 is the allowance in 171 of the innocent tenant defense. And as indicated at the trial court and with Judge Cook, I do have tenants who copy the 171 language verbatim. And in that situation, there is an innocent tenant defense, perhaps, per the lease. But here, the only innocent tenant defense is per the statute. And the Phillips case has addressed that, and they say, we are not persuaded that the innocent tenant defense in 181 at the time avails the tenants of their right to escape eviction just because they didn't have knowledge about the illegal activity occurring at the property. And the ultimate holding that I'm looking to Rucker for is the commentary on the public policy that it's not absurd for a landlord or the government to insist upon drug-free housing at the expense of tenants who might not be aware.
In other words, you're saying that Rucker stands for the proposition that it would not be a violation of offensive to public policy or absurd if the lease in this case imposed a strict liability penalty.
Correct.
And again, that assumes that we have the lease to consider. If we don't have the lease and we're just looking at the statute and the interpretation of the covenants in the statute, is your argument the same?
Yes, because Phillips interprets 181, now 171, to say that the innocent tenant defense doesn't apply.
I was referring to, all right, when you say 171, you mean 504B 171.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and it was 181 under the Phillips case.
Now, you cite our opinion in Loge, I don't know if it's Loge or Loge, for the proposition that the word allow, as distinguished from the word permit, does not include a knowledge requirement.
Yeah, that was the case, I believe, where the son was driving his dad's car and there was an open bottle underneath the seat.
Right. Now, you don't cite the Supreme Court opinion that reviewed our opinion, and it analyzed the statute differently. It was keep or allow, and the Supreme Court, in analyzing the issue, expressly says we're not going to comment on the allow part of it. We're only going to decide the case based upon the keep. In the keep
okay.
or allow. So I'm curious as to what your opinion is as to how we should treat our own decision in Loge, given the Supreme Court's apparent different course.
Well, I think
the decision, but under a different reasoning.
Sure. Well, let's look to Referee Labine's his finding of fact, paragraph 45. Michael Lee was allowed into the lease property by his 20-year-old daughter. I mean, I'm citing Lowe's, I mean, not for the sole reason why I win on allow, but
I want you to focus on that part of it.
Yes.
Because I want to get a sense from you as to whether you believe that part of Loge is binding on how we analyze the definition of allow in this case, because you do cite it and quote the language in your brief.
I appreciate how the Supreme Court may have walked that back a little bit, and to that extent, Loge might not be as controlling as it might once have been had the Supreme Court not reviewed that. But the other case from Louisiana talks about the Green case from Louisiana. Control does not mean if you have somebody in your household who is out of control that, as a matter of law, you're excused from the consequences of their actions. This is somebody who came to the apartment. He did not break in. He knocked on the door, rang the bell. The minor daughter answered the door. The adult daughter, who a co-lessee, responds and lets him in. It looked like he needed a shower is basically what she told the referee. That's allowing somebody into your apartment. And to be clear, the no-knock search warrant executed on March 8th was not a result of the police tracking a guy who they thought had drugs on him, watched him go into the apartment, quickly got a no-knock search warrant, and then ran in the apartment and found the drugs. This has been going on for some time. And the findings of fact from Referee Levine, these facts, this is paragraph 32.
You say this had been going on for some time. What is the this? He was entering the home or he was?
The police, the testimony of the officers at trial, they thought he lived there. I mean, I'm not.
I'm just trying to get a sense. When you say this was going on for quite some time, you're not saying we have evidence that of drug use going on for some time in the apartment. You're saying that the Mr. Lee's going to the apartment repetitively is known to the police and had been going on for some time.
I'm saying both. I mean, the no-knock search warrant was based off of continuous surveillance. They had seen drug activity from Mr. Lee around the area. They got the no-knock, they got the search warrant based off of surveillance. And when they entered the apartment, Referee Levine says, of paragraph 32, these facts support the finding that Saritha Lee knew or should have known that Michael Lee or other tenants were using marijuana at the leased property. Paragraph 47, there is reason to believe that tenants knew about the marijuana. Paragraph 31, the court finds it hard to believe that Saritha Lee did not know that Michael Lee was using marijuana in the leased property.
There are no similar findings as to the other claimed illegal activities, is there?
Correct. There's no specific finding that the tenants knew about the stolen property, knew about the gun in the garage. But I want to back up just one little bit.
You are out of time, but you'll be
able
to
that later.
Jump
Thank
in
you.
On your rebuttal time if you'd like, Mr. Kalla. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Sarah Peterson, attorney for respondent tenants Saritha and Zanitra Lee, and Ms. Saritha Lee is present today. The heart of this case is whether tenants who were not involved in any wrongdoing can be evicted for the actions of a third-party non-leaseholder.
Can I ask a big-picture question for you, Ms.
Yes.
Peterson, as well? The parties didn't seem to address this in the briefing, and I'm or perhaps appellant did, but I don't see a response in the respondent's brief. There's a lot of analysis as to what the covenants in the statute, the statutorily required covenants, as opposed to the lease language. Assuming for the sake of argument that the lease that is operative is, or the language is fairly in front of us, is there anything in the statute that would prohibit a landlord from being more restrictive than the covenants or in a lease? Can a lease give the landlord more power to impose, for example, strict liability, even if the covenants might be read as you have argued they should be read?
So Your Honor has already pointed out that the lease covering the alleged breach conduct is not in evidence, is not in the record before this court. If the lease covering the time period of the alleged breach was in the record and part of the, and before this court, the state statute, Minnesota statute 504B.171, has a non-waiver provision which includes language that says subdivision 3 of 504B.171. Parties to a lease or license of residential premises may not waive or modify the covenant imposed by this section. And it's our position that that provision specifically does not allow a landlord to provide a more restrictive standard.
Is there case law that supports that? I mean, if a party can't waive or modify the covenants, I don't know how that, you can still have these covenants in place and still require, landlord could still impose strict liability. If criminal activity occurs in this apartment, eviction results. Are you saying that you read subdivision 3 to prohibit the landlord from being, from imposing a strict liability?
Yes, that's correct. The statute was written by our legislature and has the words allow, which it's our position is not a strict liability standard. Your Honor has brought up the Rucker case and the issues with analogizing that case to the case here.
Well, before we get to Rucker, I'm going to ask you about a case that's a little bit more specific in defining the term allow.
Yes.
It's in a different circumstance, but I noticed that your brief does not respond to the appellant's argument about our Loge decision,
yes,
which is clear in defining the term allow as not including a scienter element. I'm curious as to why you didn't address that argument.
As was pointed out during appellant's argument, the citation to the definition of allow in the Loge case refers to the Court of Appeals decision, and it later went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court specifically chose not to focus on the meaning of allow, but rather...
Well, but we still have our published opinion there. I posed to your opponent as to what effect our opinion or the Supreme Court's decision might have. The Supreme Court didn't reverse our decision, but decided it on a different ground. What is the status of our published opinion in Loge as a matter of procedure and precedent?
I believe that it was not, that part of the decision was not reversed. Under the circumstances, it's just not, looking at the whole context of the case, the Supreme Court chose to not address that specifically. And
wasn't reversed, wasn't affirmed, it's just
right.
A nothing?
Well, there is a case from this court following that decision, State versus Wolsall, Inc., 670 Northwest 2nd, 292 from 2003. And that did address a similar argument about the meaning of the word allow. That opinion states that the state's assertion that the Supreme Court in Loge held that allowing an open bottle in a vehicle does not require proof of knowledge or intent is incorrect. In Loge, the Supreme Court specifically limited its opinion to an analysis of to keep based on the facts of the case and did not analyze the alternative manner of violation not presented in that case of allowing to be kept.
You said this is Wursel? What's the name of the case? I don't see that in your brief. Is it in your brief that I meant?
It was not.
Okay. The parties didn't find this. I was just curious about how the legislature might use the term allow. And there's a few places I found where in different statutes applying to different issues where the legislature refers to knowingly allow. Minnesota statute 84.802, for example, refers to an owner of an off-road vehicle may not knowingly allow it to be operated in violation of this section. And there's a few other places I found. Minnesota statute 221.036, 326B84, applying similar language. So there are places where the legislature apparently does not assume, as you have and as the district court has, that the word allow implies a knowingly element, that if you want knowingly, you include it in the actual text. Given that, assume that it's accurate. I know your opponent didn't cite these provisions, but assume that I'm accurate and that the legislature has on multiple other occasions included the word knowingly before the word allow. What, if anything, does that tell us about the legislature's intent and definition of the word allow here?
It's our position that the first starting point would be to look at the plain language of the statute, and that may include dictionary definitions. So when examining the dictionary definitions of allow, it seems to require something in terms of knowledge. there is a statutory construction provision that every law shall be construed, if possible, to give effect to all its provisions. And I believe that under appellant's argument that knowledge is not included in the word allow, that would render the word allow in the statute superfluous.
Right. So I'm trying to get a sense of what, in the statutes that I've referred to, that I acknowledge are not in front of you, you didn't have them before today, so forgive me for blindsiding you, but if the legislature has included the word knowingly before the word allow in other circumstances, does that not indicate that the legislature does not always use the term as you're suggesting it is used, that allow does not necessarily include a knowing element?
It's a little bit of a guessing game to determine what the legislature intended, especially if they did not include the word knowingly before the word allow. But I think if we look at other cases where strict liability is imposed.
No, I'm just trying to get a sense as a matter of construction of the word. If the legislature uses the word knowingly before allow in some circumstances and not in others, why shouldn't we infer that the legislature has a distinction between knowingly allow and allow unknowingly?
I think this goes back to the plain meaning. I believe that if the legislature did not intend for knowledge to be part of the word allow, the statute 504B.171 would have been written in a different and more clear manner.
You're saying that if the legislature intended a strict liability provision, they surely knew how to write that.
Yes.
I'm going to poke at another part of your argument that I was curious about, and that is the distinction between a petty misdemeanor and a crime. And if I understand your argument correctly, your position is that because the possession of a small amount of marijuana is only a petty misdemeanor, it doesn't meet the statutory term unlawful possession of drugs. Am I correct at that? Have I interpreted your argument accurately?
I believe what I was referring to was 504B.171, subdivision 1A2, that first sentence of that provision, which discusses, it makes reference to possession of a controlled substance in violation of criminal provision in Chapter 152. And the lower court did discuss marijuana at the property, but overall found that there was no good cause for eviction, that appellant did not meet its burden of proving that there was good cause to evict.
Because it
respondents.
Was only a petty?
The lower court did not make that distinction.
But you're making the distinction. That's what I'm trying to get a sense of. You're supporting the lower court's decision based upon this distinction between a petty misdemeanor and a crime.
Yes.
But the statute refers to unlawful as opposed to criminal. Are you saying that a petty misdemeanor is not unlawful?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I think I was specifically trying to refer to subdivision 1A2, and even if there could be found that the petty amount of marijuana was unlawful, that nonetheless the district court did not make any, the district court concluded that there was no good cause for eviction. And appellant makes the argument that there was good cause to evict the tenants, but does not put put forth any reason why and is not able to show that those findings made by the lower court were clearly erroneous. And we don't have any transcript here in the record before.
You agree, I don't think there's a dispute, that the district court did find that an adult on the premises, the daughter, knew or must have known about the marijuana possession. Is that an accurate
description
of the finding?
The findings are speculative. They're more almost dicta. The district court doesn't even get into.
What do you mean the findings are dicta? I mean, we have to base our decision on the findings of the district court.
The findings don't address how the marijuana interplays with 504B.171. And actually, the issue of the marijuana was
I thought your argument was that the district court implicitly had the interplay between 504B.171 as indicating that unlawful is distinguished from petty misdemeanors. I thought that was the heart of your argument on that point. Is it? Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not trying to trip you up. I'm just trying to understand what your argument is.
I believe there was kind of a leap made maybe between marijuana and finding that there was no real discussion regarding marijuana and 504B.171. There was a small discussion about marijuana, and then it went to there was no good cause. Appellant could not prove good cause to evict tenants.
So why are you saying that implicit in the trial court's conclusion that since this was a marijuana petty misdemeanor, that while it might be an unlawful, it's not as unlawful as something which is a crime, and therefore good cause didn't exist? Is that what you're suggesting that the trial court had in mind here?
I believe the issue at the trial were the cocaine and the prohibited stolen firearm. And the district court may have opined about marijuana, but that was not the heart of the issue here. And overall, there was no good cause finding. And I see that my time is up.
I was connecting some dots that weren't there. Is that what you're saying? Is there a gap between the trial court's musing about the marijuana and its coming to its conclusion that there was no good cause?
I think so. I think that's correct.
But there are other crimes that supposedly were there. The stolen property, and so I'm trying to figure out what.
And the district court made specific findings regarding the stolen property and the other controlled substance that was found, and interpreted the Minnesota State Statute 504B.171 as requiring knowledge, and there was a finding that there was no knowledge as to those activities.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Any rebuttal?
And here's my problem with 171, and that is, even if you set aside the lease as not being part of the court's analysis at all, the knowledge requirement in terms of knowingly allow or just allow, that distinction is expressly addressed in 171 subdivision 2. It says the covenant is not violated, and this is on page 10 of my brief, the covenant is not violated when a person other than the landlord or licensor or the tenant or licensee possesses or allows controlled substances in the premises, common area, or curtilage, unless the landlord or licensor or the tenant or licensee knew or had reason to know of that activity. And the knowledge defense in 171 is limited to acts involving controlled substances. There is no escape clause for illegal activity regarding stolen property or illegal activity regarding a felon in possession of any illegal firearm. Those two issues, it's error at the judge review proceeding when he affirms and says the knowledge requirement defense applies to both stolen property and to felon in possession. The statute expressly says the knowledge requirement applies to the controlled substances. If that sub 2 section said it just left out the controlled substances and said it's a defense if the tenant didn't know about the illegal activity in this covenant, and you can't evict them for that, that's different. But this legislature has specifically addressed the knowledge requirement as a defense to the controlled substances only. And so to address Judge Ross's concern earlier about Loge and what allow means and the knowingly allow in other cases, I think the legislature has taken that issue and addressed it straight on.
Except for the fact that, I mean, if I read subdivision or paragraph 4, allow stolen property or property obtained by robbery in these premises, and there's nothing that prohibits, I mean, if the word allow implies knowledge, that would be consistent with including the provision that you were relying upon in paragraph 2.
I think that provision in paragraph 2, the underlying portion I have in page 10, would be superfluous. You wouldn't need it. If this court is going to interpret the word allow in those four preceding subdivisions regarding controlled substances, prostitution, firearm, and stolen property, if this court's understanding is that word allow implies or necessitates knowledge, then we don't need the last sentence in subdivision 2.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that the legislature has repeated itself, would it? Or for that matter, lawyers. And lawyers have to say everything three times just to make it clear. The legislature on occasion says it more than once as well, doesn't it?
Sure. And when you've got one statute here and one statute there, maybe they're not adopted at the same time, different legislatures, different committees, et cetera. I get that. But I think it's conspicuous that the knowledge defense in sub 2 is just talking about controlled substances. And if somebody wanted to make that change, they would have. And the difference between 171 and 181 is the addition of the word landlord or lessor. That same knowledge defense is in 504B-181 when the Phillips case was addressed as well.
How'd the Phillips case address it?
Well, the tenants spent an inordinate amount of time saying that there's a defense that they didn't know about it. And the Court of Appeals says, doesn't matter. The public policy controls and we're allowed to.
So our precedent in Phillips was not based on the statute, it was based on public policy? This court just rewrite the statute then for a public policy reason?
Well, Phillips says it's undisputed that the cocaine was the property of Anthony Brown and that neither Mary Brown nor her daughters knew of its presence. And then they say at head note 3, appellant also argues that she did not violate the lease and that she had no control over Anthony, who did not violate it. However, the lease provides that if prohibition against the drugs is violated, landlord has the option of voiding the lease. And it says, it says the lease can control whether there's a knowledge defense in there or not. And there's no dispute that the tenants had agreed to that. So I would think that the Phillips case says, look, your knowledge defense, if the knowledge defense was to be applied today at the same time it should have been in Phillips, then Phillips should have said those tenants get to stay.
Based on the lease.
Yes, and I appreciate Judge Ross's concern about what lease we have in evidence, but...
So if we don't have the lease in evidence, and if our conclusion is that we don't have a record basis to conclude what the lease said at the time of the eviction, where are we on this subject?
Well, I'm not supposed to question the hypothetical, but I object. I mean, the tenants never objected to this issue at the trial court.
And right, but we're not in the trial court. You're in the Court of Appeals, and in the Court of Appeals, we can only consider the record that's in front of us, regardless of what the district court considered. The district court considered something but didn't include a record of it. What is the basis on which we would reverse language that's not in front of us? I mean, here's my question for you. Let me pose it a different way. I know you don't like the hypothetical, but I'm going to ask you to accept the hypothetical.
Sure.
Assume that we don't have the lease in front of us, that is was applicable at the time of the eviction, would we then look at the statute and apply the statute and then decide whether, regardless of whether the lease might be more restrictive than the statute, apply the language of the statute?
At best, that line of analysis might deprive the landlord of evicting for the controlled substances, but it does not provide the...
No, I just mean as a matter of procedure. You agree that we would still apply the statute because the statute is... imposes covenants that must be included in every lease.
Yes, even if there's just an oral lease or no lease at all, just permission of a landlord to allow a tenant to occupy a building, these covenants apply to that agreement regardless. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your argument and for your briefing. The matter is submitted, and we'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.